Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Monty Walden. How are you, Monty?
Pretty good, Chris. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Monty is, well, you're a famous wino.
Famous wino? Yeah. Make me sound like I'm drunk. Where's this interview going?
It's going well at the moment. No. You're famous in the wine community. You've been on TV. You've done all sorts of stuff, really. What I want to do is just have a chat about your journey through wine.
Okay.
If that's possible. Because you've done lots of stuff, and you're reasonably well respected. But let's start off with your first glass of wine.
Probably the first glass of wine, I may have made it myself actually when I was about 11 or 12, making wine at home. Mm-hmm. My parents would have a glass of fairly horrible Cyprus sherry in a decanter on the little cupboard in the living room. And I was kind of fascinated by the smell, by the taste. And so I started making some wine at home. And I wasn't really very good.
How did it turn out?
It was very sweet. Probably didn't fully ferment. I think I had a cousin actually who was a doctor who kind of showed me a little bit about making wine at home. But when I went to school, my sort of proper school, I had to learn French, and I really wasn't that good at studying French. And my French teacher said, "Look, you got to go to France. You got to spend some time there because it's the only way you're going to learn because you're a little bit thick." And I, long story short, I ended up in Bordeaux working on a vineyard, and I just suddenly felt right. This is it. I found what I want to do. And I was very, very comfortable with it. I probably didn't do as much French study as I wanted, but I learned an awful lot about wine, traveling around Saint-Emilion a lot, and just really seeing and relating to how wines really did taste different from different terroirs, different slopes. Where's the sun rising? Where's it setting? Where's the vineyard facing? And just thinking, if I was a vine, would I be happy in this place? Would my feet be damp? Would they be warm? Would my shoulders be sunny? And I really kind of started thinking about wine in that way, and I felt I had an affinity to it.
And how old were you then? That was...
Well, I think I first went to Bordeaux when I was about 16, then I went back again when I was 17, then I went off and did my degree, but I knew exactly what I was going to do. As soon as I left with my degree in English and History, I was straight back out to Bordeaux. And I
did you think about doing biology or something like that?
No, not really, no. I mean, I could have done an MA in modern poetry at Stirling University, but I got a place to do that. I just thought, no, I want to go back to Bordeaux and I want to actually make the wine this time rather than just sort of look at vineyards and look at people doing it. And 1989 was like we started picking on the 23rd of August, I think, for sparkling wine, making some Crémant de Bordeaux. And it was just so exciting. You know, you're really involved in creating something. You don't really know how it's going to turn out. So there's a bit of mystery, a bit of magic. And also, you've got to make money from it. And the guy I worked for actually really did struggle financially. So I really learned at the coalface how hard wine growing can be. Mm. There's the romance and there's the brutal reality.
So how long were you in Bordeaux for making wine? Is it just one vintage?
No, I went. I did the 89 vintage. I did the 93, 94. In 90, I worked in Carneros for Walter Schug. Then in 93, then I came back and did the harvest in Bordeaux. I worked the summer in Germany in 94, and I did that because I did the early harvest in Chile in 94, so in spring. Met a German winemaker there, Stefan Dors from the Pfalz. He's now really well known in Germany. So I did the spring in Chile with a flying winemaker team, which led by Jacques Lerton, and summer in Germany, then autumn in Bordeaux. So I kind of like did two and a half, three harvests almost in 1 year. Jacques Lerton was great as a flying winemaker because he just got juice samples from all the different plots of Sauvignon or Sauvignon-ass, and he was just tasting all these juice samples, already planning where everything was going to go. 7 million litre winery at the time. This was Vigna San Pedro. And I hadn't seen that level of detail in the guys working with in Bordeaux, because obviously Jacques was a really kind of professional winemaker, whereas the guy I worked for in Bordeaux had sort of inherited a vineyard, if you like. It had come to him by accident, whereas with Jacques, obviously his parents had vines as well, but he'd really studied it, and it was a much more professional way of making wine. And I'd never really realized how the technical side was so important. And so all the time I was learning, basically. And
but you never did study wine in an academic fashion?
No, I've never studied winemaking, no. I'm not a very good student.
Yeah. Okay, so that got you up to what, 1990? So you've been doing vintages. Were you actually a winemaker, or were you more a cellar rat, so to speak?
Well, I mean, the 93 I was a cellar rat, but when I did the experience in Bordeaux in spring 94, and then with Stefan in Germany, the harvest 94 in Bordeaux, the actual owner of the chateau, because he was under such financial pressure, he actually had a heart attack before the vintage. He was okay, but he couldn't, and wasn't like a fatal heart attack, but I was basically, I made the wine. And I had like one pump that worked. I had like nine tanks to pump over. Some of them were like 260 hectolitres. No safety ladders, climbing up on coves. And so I had to be really, really careful. You get tired as well, so you make mistakes. So, that really was a hard experience, but I learned a lot. And the consulting enologist we had is a guy that's fixed all the top growths. You know, he's fixed Riocas, he's fixed Margaux, he's fixed Santimignons.
Fixed Desmond.
Well, you know, sometimes you're going to have to do a few tricks in the winery. So I started learning about that side of the business, the kind of, again, the romantic. So there's the romantic side, then there's the business side, then again the kind of flip side of that brutal reality where you need to sell your wine, and if you're going to blend something in, you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So that's why when I became a journalist, started writing about it, I've always been a little bit more skeptical maybe than some of my peers. When people say X is X, I say, actually no, in your case X is probably Y times two. So maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing, maybe I'm too skeptical. I think it's good to be sceptical, though.
Oh, no, definitely good to be sceptical. So that was, what, that gets you up to about the mid-90s?
Yeah, and then what did I do then? Then I started writing a book called Bordeaux Unfiltered with a guy who's now master wine, Richard Kershaw. He's now got his own brand in South Africa, Kershaw Wines, absolutely fantastic guy. And we just zoomed around Bordeaux in 96, visited, I don't know, a couple of hundred estates and tasted everything. And we just felt that there was a lot of hype. This is when Bordeaux was just starting to take off and being seen really first and foremost as an investment. So we did this book called Bordeaux Unfiltered, which was never published. And one of the leading wine writers at the time, who was head of the Circle of Wine Writers, read it. He said, you know, he said, why aren't you going to publish it? So we're a little bit nervous. We really don't want to get taken to court. He said, no, rubbish, publish it. Get it publicly burnt in Bordeaux, in the centre of Bordeaux. You'll become world famous. We thought, yeah, we get it.
So it was obviously a bit...
Yeah, it was a little bit. I mean, it was had a lot of attitude, but... You know, we did actually dig out some really, really good wines from some smaller producers, and you know, we weren't very commercially savvy. I knew a wine merchant at the time who I respected a lot, and he's still a guy called Roy Richards, and he's got a great palate. And I recommended a few wines to him. Just said, look, you should see this guy, and he was shipping them sort of 10, 15, 20 years later. So that gives you confidence that your palate is quite good, that you mm-hmm. can spot a dog and a beauty queen, spotting a decent wine, and you think, well, this guy's kind of working with people like Le Pin and Viachette Certain. So again, that, you know, so I thought, well, maybe I'm not quite so stupid as I thought I was. You know, at school I was never like the top of the class, and so I was kind of building the, I suppose, a bit more confidence in
context.
Yeah, and in being sort of good at wine, if you like. And then I sort of got commissioned to, because I was quite polemical, and word got round. I did a short TV program on Bordeaux, sort of polemical side of Bordeaux, and some of the abuses, like really bad soil management, a lot of chemicals and stuff.
Yeah.
And then a lot of additions in the winery to correct that, enzymes and sugar and water and all the rest of it. And long and the short, that actually led to me writing my first book for Friends of the Earth, which is an environmental organisation commissioned by, he's now the Evening Standard wine writer, Andrew Neither. And that was the Wine Guide of the Year. As I was writing that, I didn't have any money, so I went to actually write it in the Sherry country because I could rent somewhere really cheap to live. It was like 20 quid a week.
Yeah.
So with no phone, and anyways, to send the copy back, I had to get a bus to go to an internet cafe to send the chapter to HarperCollins. And then I moved to California for 7 months and worked with the Fetzer family and did a biodynamic sort of biodiversity project with them. And that was a real eye-opener. And I discovered biodynamics when I was doing the Bordeaux Unfiltered thing, when I went to a winery and I tasted a guy's wine that was recommended to me by the enologist that knew how to fix all these wines. But he was a good guy. It wasn't like he was a crook. And he said, go and see this producer in Fronzac one day, Paul Barr. And I said, why? He said, oh, he's doing something that you may find interesting. So I went to this guy and I tasted one. It was brilliant. It was clear. It was pure. It had a story to tell. I said, what are you doing? He said, nothing. I said, well, you must be, because my friend told me that you're doing something. He said, oh, I'm doing this thing called biodynamics. What? Biodynamics, what the hell's that? And so he took me into his vineyard. And there were two vineyards actually next to each other. He said, which do you think is mine? I said, well, it can only be the one on the left. He said, how do you know? Because your soil looks like it's alive. I can dig my hands in. I can smell the soil. And the one next door is like cement. So I'd kind of passed the dumb idiot test. And then he explained, right, biodynamics is X, Y, and Z. And I said, who's doing it in Bordeaux? There were five at the time, like 10,000 wine growers, five of which were biodynamic. So I then visited all five of them. And I started building up a picture of this. There's a bit about the moon and a bit about the stars and a bit about spirituality and a bit about horns. And over a period of time, I just pieced it together. And having done it in California, I could sort of see the reality, the practical side, not the theoretical side. I always learn better when I'm doing the practical side. And I don't know, I just got it. I just felt it was a system that worked.
We'll talk about biodynamics later on. We'll do another interview on biodynamics because you're quite What's the word I'm after?
Fundamentalist. He doesn't shut up, that Blake Walden. It's him and a biodynamics four hours later.
Yeah, you like to talk about biodynamics. We came in and sat down first thing, it was 20 minutes of biodynamics.
Well, you asked the question.
One question.
Okay, it required quite an in-depth answer.
Yeah, well, maybe it was a good question.
It was.
So anyway, when did you start doing things like Chateau Monty? That was sort of, for me, that was the first time I'd really sort of seen you. Had you done much between sort of Caneros and Chateau Monty, or what was the...
No, I did. I think I did one or two things on radio, Radio 4, things like that, but nothing really linked to, nothing obviously like a sort of a TV show. And that TV show sprang from the Organic book, and I guess I was writing a column in Harper's at the time. And through sort of friends of friends, guy that worked in TV said, you know, do you ever make wine? We'll do a TV program. So I thought, okay, I won't turn that down as an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I'd worked in Roussillon before. I worked with Gobi in 2006. I did a stage with him, and I worked with, at the time he was sort of a partner in a winery called La Sula, and the vineyards belonged to a guy, most of them belonged to a guy called Eric Laguerre, and I did a stage and I really loved the place. I thought, right, if I'm going to do a biodynamic wine, it's going to be here. And you know, life is all about not making things difficult for yourself.
It looked like you'd made it difficult.
Well, yeah, I had issues with my back as well. But in terms of a terroir, I mean, it's a great place. It's got a fantastic climate, very few pests, a lot of wind. And if you're going to be organic, that's pretty easy. You have no excuses really not to be, or at least organic. And to add the biodynamic bit wasn't actually that difficult.
But it was only the soils weren't biodynamic to start off with.
No, they were certified organic.
Okay.
Yeah, they were certified organic. Yeah, absolutely. And so I did, in the first year, I just did a red. That was one on TV. And the second year, I did a red, a rosé, and a white. And the white was kind of slightly ahead of the natural wine movement time. It was, I don't want to be rude, but it was a little bit probably cleaner than some of them. And it was a great wine. But, you know, Silvano and I had a baby at the time, and I'd commuting from Italy to France. Education, I don't have any, my family was ill at the time. It was all a bit complicated. In the end, I thought, I'm not making too much money. I'm going to come back to this, and the next time I do it, I'll do it even better than I did the first time. I just made very little margin, basically.
Yeah.
And I didn't really...
But that is a problem with wine growing in that region sometimes, isn't it? There's a lot of winemakers making little money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always say to people, I'm the only guy that's had his own TV show that doesn't have his own range of cutlery. And I could have milked it, I suppose, but I'm not, you know, I'm lippy, but I'm not... I'm the guy that holds the door open for other people, unfortunately. And I'm not generally me. So... And I just thought, yeah, it's on TV, but so what? It's not going to change my life. I don't want it to change my life. I really enjoy what I was doing. The wines were really good. People who drank them really, really liked them, and they thought they were good value. So for me, that's five boxes ticked. Yeah. I'm really happy. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I'll be absolutely delighted.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, the six box of making a shitload of money is quite a nice one.
Yeah, I mean, I should have actually taken some advice. I mean, Mike Paul, great marketing guy, and a guy that was working at Waitrose at the time, who did actually take some of the wine. So we don't really have a really good brand from Languedoc, from Roussillon, from that area, and you should be it. And I just said, okay. But I didn't do anything about it. So, and I, in a way, I kind of regret that, because I think I want people to have wine that I like, everyday wines.
Yeah,
wines that you drink every day. You don't really think about them. You enjoy them, but you're having your dinner, you're talking to your family, you're eating your food, you have nice food, nice wine, but it's not the be all and end all. You know, you go into the supermarket and you got to buy toothpaste, right? Do I buy the one with the blue stripes or the white stripes? Tampons, do I buy these ones or that one? The wine aisle, it's like panic. There's just so many wines in there. It's so difficult, so complicated. People have this massive fear about what should be part of your sort of daily bread almost. And I think that's a real shame. And I think the Chateau Monty thing was almost a way of hoping to say to people that it's not that difficult. It's us that make it difficult for you. It's not, in essence, very difficult. And I think that's probably the big issue that the wine industry has to address. There's so many brands out there. Do we always make it easy for people?
Do you want to tell us what you're doing now? Because you moved back to Italy to be with your wife and child. How old is your child now?
He's five, Arthur.
Five.
Yeah. Bilingual, good little lad, yeah.
Yeah, bilingual, as in he can speak Italian.
And English, yeah.
And English, and not French.
We did take him on the second vintage. He was in France when he was 10 days old. And he always, when he hears a French voice, he always smiles. And Savannah always says that's because he did my second vintage in France with me there. So maybe that's true, I don't know.
Yeah, and so you're based in Italy. Are you making wines in Italy?
No, I did one Tuscan wine with a producer in San Gimignano. And again, Arthur was sort of born, I think, when that vintage was going on. And it just was all a bit complicated.
Yeah.
And so I stopped doing that. And as I said, when I do it the next time, and there is something in the pipeline, I'll get it right, and you're going to hear all about it, and everyone will be sick of me talking about my new project.
Okay. So, but it's coming. Something's in the pipeline, you're saying?
Yeah, if the weather holds, then hopefully there'll be another wine out next year.
Okay.
So, yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, you know, the reason I went to Tuscany was in 04 or 05, I had to write a book, A Tuscan Wine Guide, for Mitchell Beasley. So I had 6 months to do it. I didn't speak a word of Italian, so I got a flight. Enrolled in a Siena language school. Again, Stormer was not the best student. But I stayed in a winery where my partner Silvana was working. She completely snubbed me initially. She just didn't want to know. Anyway, long story, we became very good friends, and then obviously we've ended up, we're not married, but we're 7 years, 8 years together.
Yeah.
And kind of pretty idyllic lifestyle. And in Tuscany, what I've been doing there is starting to do a little bit of consulting on the organic and biodynamic stuff, and because the issues that people face there are kind of climate change, and my idea is that the problems that they mainly face are tannins that aren't really stable because the grapes are getting too hot, and so we're just working with producers to try and find strategies to cool their soils down a little bit so that their ripening is a little bit slower and you get a little bit more complexity into the wine, a little bit better balance, wines that age a bit better and that don't fall apart too quickly.
Okay, we'll explore that in a wee bit. And also now you're the chair of the Decanter Tuscan, is that right?
Yeah, the chair of it's the Decanter World Wine Awards. I've been Tuscan chair now. We just finished the second year, I was chair last year, and I was sort of, Rosemary George was doing it 3 years ago, and Rosemary sort of suggested to Decanter that I succeed her because she's spending more time in Languedoc now, not enough time in Tuscany, so very generously she put me forward. And it's brilliant. I mean, as a competition, I love it. It's really, really serious. Get some really, really good people to taste with. It's nice also to be, when I'm back in, away from Italy, back in the UK, you realise that, I mean, everybody has a different opinion.
Yeah.
On wine, and what you like, somebody else might not like, but in the end you're just saying, is this a good, as we're told every day by Stephen Spurrier, is this a good wine, not do I like it? And that's the way it should be for this kind of competition. So I when we look at the results, I think most of the time we get it right, and that's our job, and we have that responsibility to take it really seriously, to do a really good job. And I do think we, certainly for Tuscan, I do think most of the time we get it right.
Do you judge any other competitions?
No.
Just the Decanter?
Just that one, yeah.
Okay, cool. All right then, I think we're going to wrap it up there, Monty.
Okay, nice one.
Thank you very much.